So the time is 8:40. With us today we have Representative Moses, Representative Holm, Representative Kelly. Representative Wyrock was here, Representative Hawker, Representative Jewell, Representative Katina, Vice Chair Schultz, Co-Chair Meyer, and myself, Co-Chair Chenault. Today we'll take up 488 PPT again. I think that we'll probably get tired of it before it's all said and done. With us today, we're going to try something a little bit different. We posed some questions to a panel of experts. That's a good title for you guys.
paid employees.
And with us today, we have Marianne Kaw. Chief Economist for ConocoPhillips. We have Dr. Tony Finizza, Special Consultant to Econ One. We have Barry Pullman, Senior Economist for Econ One. We have Dan Dickerson, Consultant Tax Division Revenue. Angus Walker, Commercial Vice President for BP. And David Bramley, Vice President of CRA International. Representative Wyrock is with us, and Representative Foster has joined us. There's been some question, I guess, how did we get to where we're at today? And I think how we got there is we've all listened to presentations, whether through resources or through the Finance Committee, from each of the individual companies that may be involved, from the Administration, Department of Revenue, from our economists. And I think there was some interest that maybe some of it's confusing because each corporation and each division have a little bit different twist on what the effects of the proposed PPT would have on their entity. And I'm sure that as far as the corporations go, the makeup of their corporation, it does make a difference in more ways than one on their business and on their bottom line. And so what we've done is we've asked her some questions. I think that she's making a copy to put them out. And we did give the questions to everybody early so that they at least have an idea of what they were going to be hit with. If we go through these questions and we have other questions or we go down a different trail, then, the committee's more than welcome at any time to cut in and ask another question or ask for some clarity on that. So with that, we can start out. And I guess the first question would be, and I'll read the questions so everybody will know what they are. Legislators took an oath to maximize return on resources for the benefit of Alaskans. In your opinion, and this is the panel, what do you believe the best proposal to maximize this return while at the same time encouraging investment and exploration to extend the production life of our gas and oil resources? So,
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to challenge a little bit the basis of the question, because I believe that encouraging investment and exploration to extend the production life of oil and gas resources is maximizing the benefit of our resources for all Alaskans. And so obviously when the governor put together a bill, he put together a bill that he thinks does that. I think any time we look at very short-run dollars, we're not going to be focusing on what's important here. I think the investment features in this bill are important. And, we believe that the governor struck the best balance in the proposal that he put forward. And I just think it is important that the long term is taken into account as well as the short term.
Okay. Angus?
Thank you. Through the chair, I think it's obvious that barrels in the ground have no value whatsoever to Alaska or Alaskans. And therefore, I would agree entirely with Mr. Dickinson in that what we need to do is maximize investment and maximize production. In answer to the question, what would be best for Alaska, we have previously been very clear that the lowest tax rate would be best for Alaska because it would stimulate investment. And just to be clear, a 1525 structure would be very much better than a 2020 structure, would be very much better than a 2025 structure.
I would, first of all, I agree with what Angus just said, but I'd also like to add that, you know, the current proposals have put in incentives for new players to come in and explore, but that does not appear to be where Alaska's future lies. Most of your reserves are in known areas and existing fields, and whatever you, whatever bill provides has to have enough incentive to get more production from existing fields. And I think the tax rate, a lower tax rate combined with tax credits would do the best job of doing that, maximizing production, maximizing investment, and maximizing revenues for the state of Alaska.
Okay.
I'll jump in here on this. I hear the comments, and I agree, I think, with Lust in general. The thing I think you don't want to get confused here is that maximizing investment for investment's sake, I don't think is the goal. I mean, there is a cost in the end, and in the end, you need to be balancing the desire to maximize investment so that you can have that additional production. The ultimate goal, of course, is to maximize the value of the resource, and for you in thinking about that, for the state of Alaska. So, of course, if your goal is simply to maximize investment, maximize production, you wouldn't have a tax, you wouldn't have a royalty. But that's, I don't think, the balance that you're looking for. And so, as you think about what you ought to do, you need to be looking for something that encourages investment. You need to be careful about the price of that, because at the same time, obviously, you want to maximize the value for the state of Alaska. As we have looked at the proposals, in our view, I'd say Dr. Finch may have some different comments on this, but the 2020, we think, is a good balance, certainly, and not, as we've said before, something that is going to be a program that overly discourages investment or truncates investment. And we think that the range between what's been talked about between the 2020 and 2520 is probably in that, you find balance in that range. We talked yesterday about some of the particulars about the CSs that we might do a little differently. I think would help improve them, but in that range we think the proposals find the right balance.
And if you would, before you speak, if you'd just say who you are so that we can get it down on record so that there's no confusion about who said what.
Tony Finita. I'm similar mind to what Barry just expressed. I do think there are enough incentives for the new fields, as I talked about yesterday. And I think one of the questions you may want to think about, because I know a number of people have talked about taxes and how increasing taxes can have a bad effect. The starting point is the status quo type of ELF, and I don't personally believe it's an onerous tax, and that movements from it, not large movements from it, and I don't believe these are large movements from it, shouldn't really stifle investment. So that would be my
Okay. Angus?
Angus Walker with BP. Maybe I could just respond to a couple of the comments that were made. First of all, this isn't investment for investment's sake. This is investment to stem the decline of the Alaska North Slope. And just to put it in perspective, the production on the North Slope is declining at 6% per year. And that means that in 10 years, the production will be half what it is today. And in 10 years, the revenue from North Slope production will be less than half what it is today, unless there is significantly more investment. So I think this is a matter of the greatest importance for Alaska. And it's not about investment for investment's sake. It's about getting investment to Alaska to develop the barrels that we know are on the North Slope, but they are difficult and challenging to develop. Thank you.
Okay. Marianne, you had a, you act like you had a comment.
Yes. I wanted to add to the comment about investment for investment's sake. It would seem to me just providing tax credits and incentives for new players to come in for new exploration versus supporting more production from existing fields, that sounds more like investment for investment's sake, because the success rates probably won't be very high and the fields that will be discovered are going to be very small. So if you really want to get maximize the value of your investment, I would think you would want to get more reserves from existing fields, particularly the heavy oil that we know is available in existing fields. Also, Tony, you said that you didn't think the increase even in the 2020 proposal was large. That's a 17% to 22% increase in the government take. I don't know of another tax regime that has gone that up that much anywhere in the world. Can you think of one? That is a very large increase, and it's bound to have an impact on investment.
Representative Meyer?
Thank you. I did have a follow-up, but I'd like to hear Econ 1's response to Marianne. We could. I think you say it's a percentage increase. I think the numbers we've looked at, you go from something like 55% to the high 50% range. So you're talking about a 4 percentage point increase in government take. It depends on the price, of course. Yeah, at low prices, in fact, the take is going to be lower. The increase, in fact, at some of the even lower prices, the take is goes the other way. So the take goes up as prices go up, and I think that is a part of what the intent and design of the bill was, to try and reach the kind of balance where government take is not large in a relative sense at lower prices, so you continue to keep the investment going when the underlying economics are not necessarily there. So I think you have to be careful when you talk about what kind of increase you're talking about in government take. And further, and I think, you know, Mr. Johnson, if he were here, could talk more about government take and what, you know, what the significance of that is and how you fit in relative to the rest of the world. I know he'll be here and can address those issues, but the numbers that we've looked at, even as you get up into some of those higher prices, don't look like they push you out of line with much of the rest of the world on government take.
Okay. Complete the response there. Tony Finizza. Well, one of the curiosities I had in terms of trying to frame in what range is it reasonable to have taxes was my observation when I first came up here that the major producers agreed to a 2020 tax regime. So my assumption was, with the governor, that that was likely to be something that they would not consider too onerous, or they wouldn't have agreed to that. So maybe above that, and I would, you know, I think you should be cautious. I wouldn't go above that personally, in a general case. But it appeared that that must have been a reasonable starting point for them to have concluded an agreement with the administration.
For the record, David Brandley. I'm looking at slide 91 of Econ1's presentation yesterday. And a price projection of $52.7 a barrel. The government take figures go from 54.4% to 62.3%. They're very similar to the figures that we had in mind, and we quoted that
the
17% to 20% range.
Yeah.
It depends how you calculate the figures, but I don't think there's too much ambiguity about that jump. But
yeah.
if I may,
yeah.
I think there is another dimension to this which has a lot of relevance, which is Alaska's competitive position. And that was the focus of our work, was trying to set the context for Alaska in terms of prospectivity and cost base, and compare with a group of comparable mature OECD producers. And in that context, the step that you're proposing, which is the step that emerges from Econ1's work just as much as ours, is a step from already a high price, a high government take in the context of that group, to one that's significantly higher. And that is fundamentally why our view is so much more pessimistic than that of some of the other consultants who've worked on this. We see this as a step from a place which is already onerous to one which is very onerous. We can't see anything other than it will have a negative impact on investment and therefore on production.
If I can make one
clarifying comment. That when you look at that 52.7 scenario, of course, those are real prices, and you're talking about if you go out in time, with 2.5% inflation, the nominal prices that go with those are pretty high out there over that whole time period. So just keep in mind when you're looking at those, that those take figures, they go with that scenario, they go with some pretty high prices.
Thanks. The danger of never getting past the first question. Yeah. but I think it's really important. What's being proposed by the governor and what's been subsequently amended will create by far the highest tax rate in the United States. And that's for a state that has the highest cost structure. I think those are both undisputed facts. But the point I wanted to pick up from the comments were the notion that if the producers agreed to it, it must be good for the industry and good for the producers. So I think we should put that in context. We've been very, very clear that we entered a negotiation with the governor on the back of the Stranded Gas Development Act, and part of that negotiation, the producers proposed a 12.5% tax rate. The governor proposed a 20% tax rate. At the end of the day, we agreed to something that was very close to the governor's deal, 20% tax rate with 20% credit, as a stepping stone to gas. We absolutely do not believe that is the optimum. We believe that it would be better for Alaska to have a lower tax rate. But we agreed to it in order to move ahead with gas. Thank you.
Thank you. Co-Chairman Chenault, and I believe this was my question, this first one here, and it's something that I think we all take very seriously. We do take an oath of office to maximize the return to our shareholders, which is the citizens of Alaska. And certainly, I've been learning a lot here in the last week to 10 days. What we saw at Kuparuk, where we do know the tax rates have been going down, but the investment's been going up. So there's obviously a direct correlation there. I guess this is just basic econ one, no offense, that as tax rates go down, investments will go up. And that's what we want, because if investments go up, hopefully we will get more oil in the pipeline. But I guess, and the other thing we've learned is that from Pioneer, actually, who's not on the panel, is that, they're trying to decide, do we invest in the Gulf of Mexico or in the state of Texas versus Alaska? And there they can work all year round. In Alaska, you got a 3, 4, 5 month window at best. And we need to do something about our regulatory and permitting process, because it seems like it takes a lot longer up here than in the lower 48. But with that in mind, I guess my question would be, I heard from BP, Angus, that 15.25 would be a better tax rate. And then obviously Mr. Dickinson thinks that the governor's 2020 is better. I guess my question, trying to drill down here a little bit, is that 15.25, 2020, would we see any difference in investment?
God, I like that.
That's what I made, because I threw the 15.25 out there. The lower the tax rate, the more investment. The higher the tax rate, the less investment. It's a very simple kind of economic relationship. It's very difficult to say how much investment will arise from any scenario. I think the difficult job of this committee and this body is to set the taxation policy for the state and create an environment which will create investment. And I believe it's an undisputable fact that the lower the tax rate, the more investment you will get.
Okay. Before you answer your question, if we can just assume, based again on what we heard from Econ 1 yesterday, that the price of oil is somewhere between $40 and $50, because I know if you have low oil or high oil prices, that would impact your decision.
Yeah.
A lot of the remaining reserves in Alaska are in a small field outside of Anwar, small field and heavy oil, which are marginally economic today, which is why you're probably not getting more investment today. The effect of lowering the tax rate will suddenly bring something that's marginal and make it economic. In one sense, it's like economically increasing the field size, you know, because it will have the same effect on net present value that a larger field size would have. So yes, I do think you'll get more investment because suddenly a lot of these marginal projects will suddenly become economic.
Well, Representative Meyer, if I might, I think it is quite true that sort of in a very simplified sense, the lower the tax, the more investment, and vice versa. But the problem is they aren't faced with, you know, they don't have a choice between investing in a state, I'll call it Alaska 1, that has a 15% tax rate, and Alaska 2 that has a 20% tax rate, and everything else is identical. That's not the choice that's faced. If that occurred, all the investment would go to the 15%. There's no question about it. What people are faced with is a competitive situation. They have a certain limited capital budget. They put it where they think it will be most effective and bring the best returns. So the question really is, you know, would dropping to 15% suddenly create a window? Would it move us beyond someone else? Would it create a window that wasn't there before? And I think that the work that Dr. Van Muir's did suggests that, you know, among our peers, at 20%, we are better off with the PPT. We are more likely to get investment. We move ahead within those peers. But again, I don't want to overestimate. There's not going to be some dramatic shift where we suddenly bypass or jump 30 or 40 other investment opportunities.
Through the chair, I think there's one statistic that you should bear in mind in thinking about this problem, and that's that over the last 5 years, for every $1 that's been invested in exploration in Alaska, more than $10 has been invested in known reserves, either new fields or the existing producing fields. That there is a reason for that, which is to do with the underlying prospectivity. And I don't think anyone would dispute that the remaining barrels are predominantly in known resources. What concerned us when we looked at some of the work on investment attractiveness is the extent to which it focused on exploration and on optimizing exploration. And the fact is that unless there is something fundamental to suggest that new exploration is going to be more prospective than exploration, and I find it hard to see why that should be. Alaska's not under licensed, and the companies you've got are the world's leading companies, that they have no reason not to look for oil. So changing the balance of investment attractiveness between investment and development in favour of investment doesn't seem a sensible way to go. It's not to say that investment doesn't have a role to play. Exploration doesn't have a role to play. It almost certainly does. But to contemplate a tax system which is focused on giving incentives for investment and giving incentives for new players, that may be fine, but it doesn't seem the sensible place to put the focus of the bill. The focus should be on optimizing that $10 that goes in known reserves rather than the $1 in exploration.
Follow-up, Representative.
I promise this is my last question. The folks at Econ 1, you were nice enough to run a graph for me at different scenarios, at 1810 and 1915. And actually, I'm looking at this, and the government take, the amount we would receive, doesn't differ much from the 2020 as proposed from the governor, especially with the price of oil being between 35 and 60, which is kind of the range we're talking about here. So is it safe to say then if we were to go to like a 1810 scenario, that would probably be more attractive, more beneficial to the existing producers and less attractive to the independents and explorers? Is that safe to say?
Start out with that one, and you can ask the producers about that. I don't know that the answer that's correct, because the credit mechanism in the bill, I think, is it's an important part of the bill. It whether it's 10 or 20, that provides a mechanism to encourage reinvestment. So even the producers, while they might say, yeah, we want a lower tax rate, but everyone wants a lower tax rate, you also would like to have a higher credit as well, because that is the mechanism within the PPT that encourages, that is designed to re-encourage encourage reinvestment. So I don't know that, that they would necessarily view it as better than, say, the explorers would.
Any other questions? Angus?
Can I just make what I think is an obvious comment? But the credit mechanism is credit mechanism in the PPT bill is the thing that we've probably had the least debate about in the committees, because I think everybody's aligned behind the fact that the credit mechanism is powerful and very appropriate for what you're trying to achieve. The real issue is the tax rate, and therefore the really important thing is to get the tax rate down to an appropriate level to attract investment, and then choose a credit. The credit system, which does the right thing for investment, but the tax rate is by far the most important lever in the whole equation. Thank you.
Bob, I think one comment on that, Representative Meyer. I want to qualify what Angus just said with one piece. At the kind of prices we're seeing today, the tax rate absolutely overwhelms the effect of the credit. No question about that. But at the kind of prices we've seen historically, may see in the future, I'm not going to make any guesses here. In fact, the two strike a better balance, and in areas of medium price or the kind of historical prices, the credits can form a very significant portion of the overall economics of investment. Yeah.
I think the two work together. So I don't think you can say, you know, set a credit at X percent and then worry about the tax rate. I think the two work together in the overall package.
And just to be clear, I don't disagree with any of that. I just think that the point I was really trying to make, and I maybe didn't make it very well, was that the consideration for these very high tax rates that is being made is the thing that's really putting this into completely the wrong place.
Representative Holm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate this discussion about the tax rates. It seems to clarify a lot of the problems that we're trying to solve in terms of where we're going to find a balance. But I'd like some discussion, not only with the tax rate on reinvestment and how that works, but also what your ideas are about how does the price, the run-up of the price of the commodity when you can sell it, how does that affect your ability, or does it at all? Because in the world market, it may not make any difference. I'm just curious if it makes any difference at all, the price of the commodity you're selling in the future, as to whether you're going to invest in Alaska or not invest in Alaska.
Can I comment on that? Well, I think the price upside is very important, particularly when you consider investing in Alaska, which is why we have big issues with sort of the windfall profits tax element of this. You know, Alaska is a very high-cost area, and we do much better. It's almost like a high price play as a part of our portfolio. So if you take away the upside, you're taking away the big advantage of having Alaska in our portfolio. So I think we're particularly concerned about that. But one comment I want to make about high prices, and I mentioned this yesterday in the Senate, if we're sitting here 2 years from now and the prices are high, it's going to be because replacement costs are that high. So the upstream margin is really not going to change that much. And this is over a 10-year average. Granted, we had record earnings last year because it takes a while for the spending and cost inflation to catch up with us. But it certainly has now, and looking forward, we view replacement costs really being over $50 a barrel today and rising. So, as again, 10 years from now, if we're looking at high prices, our costs will have caught up with that, and we really won't be looking at a more profitable environment for upstream and for your revenues.
Representative Kelly, or does anybody else have a comment on Representative Holmes' question?
I just want, if Dan will just go back to what he said, because I just really want to understand that at the current price, the tax rate is overwhelmed, so we're banking on the higher price. Is that, I just want you to elaborate on that just a little bit for me.
Representative Curtula, through the chair, I don't know what you quite mean by the word banking in that situation. What I meant was the credits are going to reward investment at the same amount no matter what the price. When you get an investment, you get a 20-40% support from the state. At the moment, if you look at, and again, if you remember the slides I went through, you know, if the gross value of the product is in the $15 billion to $20 billion range, and the total investment we're talking about is $1 billion to $2 billion, the 20% of the 20 billion is going, and that's, you know, strap cost called 15, but you know, 20% of 15 billion is obviously a much larger number than 20% of 2 billion. Even I can do that math in my head. As the gross value of the product at a smaller price falls to where it is, you know, the profit on there is also 2 to 3 billion, then in fact the two will come into equilibrium. The question I want to think about the word banking is, you know, we have put out in our fiscal note, for example, saying, gee, if prices stay where they are, where we're forecast for the next 2 years, the state will receive huge amounts of revenues as a consequence. I think what's important to focus on this bill, and it's the governor's focus, is does it also create an environment where if this price bubble bursts or whatever, there is a continuous support for investment within the state.
Thank you.
Angus?
Through the chair, can I make a comment about Representative Catula's observation? I actually believe in many ways everybody is banking on higher prices. I think price is masking the real issue, and that is that your production is declining. And as I said before, 6% decline equates to 50% of the volume in 10 years' time. So the production from the North Slope will be 50% of what it is in 10 years' time. And the only reason I believe that people are not really, really concerned about that is because of high prices. But we all know the price could evaporate in a very short period of time. So we are very concerned about it, and we think that absolute focus should be about fixing the decline, getting the investment, and getting more oil into that pipeline. Thank you.
Any other comments? Well, question one. Next, we move on to question two, and there may be some confusion about it. Econ 1 stated that 2520 was better in a low-rate environment. And I won't put words in anybody's mouth because I don't know if that's a low-rate environment, if 2520 was better for the producers or whether it was better for the state, but I guess you can clear that up for us. But what tax credit rate best meets the balance between government and industry and high and low prices? And should we even consider a two-tier system depending on price?
I think that was really a comment that came out of the new fields analysis, and it was for low prices rather than general existing fields, et cetera. And the second part, if you look at just new fields, I think the EIA type distribution of prices, which you know, it's higher than I think the producers are using. The 2520, the 2020 obviously is better for producers in that world, and it still brings in more revenue for the state. And given that there's an intent to try to put on progressivity, I'm thinking that you should not have a high tax rate at the standard range of prices, but possibly if you think about going to progressivity at a much higher price. So the 2520, I think, would be a little bit too high for the general range of prices.
Just got a new supply of donuts.
We get a new supply of donuts.
Three rings.
That's 3 days worth.
Thank you, Tony. Marianne.
About the economics at 25-20. I think the only reason why they appear to be better is because you're really subsidizing dry hole costs. Because in a successful case, you are much worse off with 25-20 than you are with 20-20. So does the state really want to be in the business of subsidizing dry hole costs rather than incenting investment in known reserves that you know are sitting there and you will definitely get production from them?
I think that's directly correct, but of course you do have to have dry hole costs if you want to be an explorer, unless someone has this magic 4D seismic
or 5D. Something.
5D. So it's like saying if I only could make sunk costs everything that didn't bear fruit, then this system is better. But unfortunately, you have to consider the full cycle. Whereas that's not the case with existing fields, since those investments have already been sunk.
Which is my point. There's a higher success rate with known reserves.
Any questions or any other comments?
Just
Representative Petrula.
And I guess it was Daniel Johnson who talked about this, but I think it was Norway where we were given the example of the tremendous credit given just this way. And, you know, that was or is a successful way of doing it. So I guess that was just the question back. I mean, that seems to be somewhat of a successful method in other places in the world.
Can I comment on Norway, please? I just so happened that the Norwegian permanent secretary came to visit me in Houston a couple of weeks ago, and I instigated a discussion with her and her staff about how successful those credits were. And I'll tell you, there was not even agreement in the Norwegian Energy Ministry about the success of those credits. They have not, in fact, seen the increase in exploration activity they were hoping. Now, this possible reason for it is the rig availability. Norway has its own specific specifications, and they just can't get the rigs in. So the jury's still out, but even the Norwegian Energy Ministry is not in agreement among themselves about how successful those credits were.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Boy, that brings up an issue to me. What's the rig availability in Alaska? I mean, that's an interesting thing you bring it up. It's my understanding that even if we had the incense today, that we're out a long, quite a ways before there would be any kind of production or increases on the North Slope anyway.
Through the chair, I can't tell you about the rig availability offhand, but just make an observation. This is a big industry with a lot of people and a lot of equipment, and it takes time to ramp up investment. I think we've been clear we're hiring people at the moment with a view to making future investments, and we're hiring 200 people this year. You've got to get the people, you've got to get the equipment, and in some cases you have to build the equipment before you can even start to make these investments. So it is very important that you have a fiscal policy that we can rely on, so that we can make the kind of decisions that it takes to ramp up the activity. But you're absolutely right, it doesn't happen overnight. Thank you.
Any other questions? Hey, will you? Richard.
I know we've got a list of questions here, and I know this is Econ 101, but I can't help but think, you know, I ran an air service for 20 years, and if a fare from Nome to White Mountain was $50, and the state moved in and said, hey, you're making too much money, we're going to tax you 10%. Well, let's see, that's $5. I'm not going to pay for it. I'll just pay the fare $55, and the consumer will pay for this. I can't help but think that ultimately, even with high prices, the consumer ultimately will pay for any increase in operating costs. It just seems logical to me. I know these are complex questions and everything, but I try to put it simplistic because I did it once in a small way, and it just seems illogical, some of the things that we're trying to do here. I don't know. I know the consumer's going to pay for this ultimately, and the prices are already very high out in Anheuser-Busch, Alaska.
Can I respond to that? Yes, I think in a very tight supply-demand environment, these costs get passed through to the consumer. But one thing we saw last year is we would have expected the rate of economic growth we had globally last year, we would have expected to see about 3 million barrels a day of global demand growth. In fact, we only saw a little over 1 million barrels a day of demand growth. So we had tremendous demand destruction last year. Prices are still high because of supply disruptions in places like Nigeria, and that's masking this. But if you look at inventory levels, for example, they're very high. So, no, you can't continue to increase prices and have consumers still buy the same amount. It doesn't work.
Generally, economists agree with that you can't keep on expecting the same level of demand as prices rise. Their code word elasticity is such, though, that it's fairly inelastic, but at some point people do not continue to consume. It makes no sense, and all you have to do is find some anecdotes about your friend who bought a Prius automobile because he wanted to use less gasoline, and it's things like that will have that effect ultimately.
I think at the beginning of your question, it was a suggestion that if taxes rose in Alaska, that would somehow cause crude oil prices generally to rise.
Globally. Yeah, everyone did that.
Right. Yeah, well, if the cost of production globally went up, and as the world runs out of, as the world gets tighter on oil, that will happen. But if you're looking at it specifically here from the state of Alaska, is what you're doing going to cause consumers elsewhere in the world to feel that? I don't think so.
Progressivity. Substantial discussion has occurred over the progressivity surcharges in the House and Senate bills. Outstanding issues of concern include inflation, the slope, and the cap. What do you consider to be a reasonable way to address these issues?
Well, since I seem to feel very strongly about not having windfall profits tax, I think the ideal solution would be not to have a windfall profits tax at all. But if there were to be one, I would say inflation adjustment is a must, because otherwise you're talking about making the investment incentive go away over time. Also, I think you'd have to set the cap high enough at a relevant range. In fact, I wanted to ask Tony. He showed a range yesterday in his economics between $20 and $55 a barrel. That's not wide enough. I mean, for years we've been using for our P10, P90 range a much wider range than that, and more upside, because we believe that crude prices are log normally distributed. There's more upside than downside. So I would think we would have to start whatever this is, the tipping point, at a much higher level to not affect investment, if that's the goal. Also, I think you cap it off at a lower level in order to maintain investment to the extent possible.
I know Barry wants to jump in here with his idea, but just to point out that my P20, P80 would be narrower than your P10, P90, and I certainly agree with that. And I think the idea of a nominal rising progressivity, as is in both CSs, does not really make sense in my mind. I think a minimum of indexing it or making it real, or some of the ideas that I think Barry mentioned yesterday.
Yeah, I think taking into account increasing costs when you're looking at the progressivity issue is important. Otherwise, as we talked about yesterday, the margin between cost of production and delivering the oil to market relative to the price at which you're triggering this progressivity shrinks. And I don't think you want that. So as I said yesterday, I would advocate on that, at least on that threshold price, that you adjust that price probably annually. I mean, it could be a more sophisticated mechanism, but probably annually as costs increase.
What if our cost inflation is going up much higher than the 2.5% general inflation?
What I would advocate adjusting it by the increase in your costs. So, as I said yesterday, dollar for dollar with increasing costs, it would be adjusted. That would preserve the margin. In general, just talking about the where to kick the threshold in, I don't think it's as simple as simply saying, well, gee, let's look at a P10 scenario and use that price. I think it's related to the tax rate, the underlying tax rate. Again, I don't think you can divorce the progressivity piece from the underlying tax rate. The extent that you're going to have a lower tax rate, I think starting with a lower threshold is okay. To the extent the tax rate is higher, I would move the threshold for progressivity up. And I would say the same thing about the slopes. To the extent that you have a lower tax rate in general, that allows for a higher slope on the progressivity, and vice versa. I do think, though, I would be, I think, in agreement generally with Tony on this, that moving it a little bit higher, something like what the House has, the $50 range, if it's indexed as I talked about before, I think that's okay, that kind of level.
Angus?
Through the chair, if I may just make a couple of things to add to that. I think if you were to choose progressivity in the ultimate solution, we agree with all the comments about making it inflation-proofing it, etc. The only three things I'd add to that is it needs to be, whatever solution you choose needs to be simple. The tax system in Alaska is already phenomenally complex. So anything you can do to simplify it through this process, I think, is advantageous for the state. I think the second thing is it needs to be balanced. So there's a true balance between the appropriate tax rate at low and medium prices and any tax rate that you chose at higher prices. And at the moment, all we've seen is a bolting on at higher prices, and that just doesn't work. And I guess the third thing I would say is would ask you to consider basing whatever you do on the realized price. And you have a marvelous mechanism through the royalty settlement agreements to arrive at the realized price of crude on the North Slope. And that's what we base our economics on. It's what we actually realize for the oil that we produce and sell. Therefore, any system should really be based on that to be effective.
Thank you. It always seemed to me that the bill, as it was introduced, had a progressivity feature in it already. When oil prices are high, you're taxing them high. Is that, am I missing that?
Thank you.
No, I think that's right.
Okay. So, okay. The other thing is Ms. Kai, you had mentioned that you wanted to start the tipping point at a higher level and start the what at a lower level?
Oh, a cap, any cap on a rate.
Start a cap on a rate.
When you get to a certain cap, when you level off, the rate increase. Have that happen at the lower level.
And Mr. Pulliam, you had indicated to move the threshold for progressivity up. Is that saying the same thing in a different manner?
I think it is in some ways. When I was talking about moving it up, I was talking about, I think, it adjusting it with changes in costs, so that if costs are increasing, the threshold. So, for instance, if you start with $50,
that addresses Ms. Kai's point on inflation.
That you're not eating into the margin there.
So you're saying the same thing essentially in a different formulaic language.
Generally the same thing on that aspect. I would agree. I mean, I would agree as we talked about yesterday that there should be a cap in there.
Well, the translation of this though has to come at some point with some specific language, and so we need to start getting specific at some point.
Could make an observation. There is a real difference between merely acknowledging general inflation and acknowledging specific costs. I mean, as an administrator, yes. if there's a cost, I mean, we can go to Marshall and Swift. There are cost indices published, which are, last year was amazing. You know, the general inflation rate was in the 2 or 3% range, and the Marshall and Swift index was three times that, approaching the 8 or 9% range. So the two can be very different, and going on the comment of simplicity, if costs are acknowledged, they need to be done in a way that you don't end up spending as much time fighting about the indexing as you do about the, what actual costs were or what deductibility.
Can I throw another wrinkle in? There's no guarantee. It is not impossible to have a fall in cost, a decrease in cost from year to year. So actually that could change the threshold in the other direction.
And
it is possible or is not?
It is possible.
We've seen it in our history.
I mean, just inflation, general inflation, the U.S. has not had dramatic periods of disinflation, deinflation, but in oil field costs, I think, you know, if you look at 1999 or something.
Yeah, 20 years, actually, of continual cost decline in the 80s and
90s. Let me ask Dan this question. I agree the mechanism would be important. Will the state not be collecting all sorts of cost information as a part of this program?
Mr. Chairman, absolutely we will be, but you know, the way it gets used is what I'm, as Rick said, the devil will be in the details.
When you talked about a threshold of when the tax would set in, they had talked about a $20 to $55 range, but the range we actually use for economics is $20 to $80. So I think even if you started at $50, you'd be shaving off a lot of our upside and impacting our net present value calculations, and it would have a very large negative impact on investment.
Say our names.
She's
trying to talk, and it does get confusing, I'm sure, for her. Representative Hawker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This whole subject discussion, you know, this last week and a half on progressivity, we've all seemed to be focusing on the House Resources approach, which is this windfall profits tax type approach, essentially, you know, establishing an index and basically taking a cut right straight off the top of your gross receipts. And we've had the ongoing discussion about how if we are going to pursue this, that we need to find a way to then index that, to inflation adjust the index. And you know, use your own vernacular, the next question is, do you want us to take off the table any other approach to progressivity? Because, again, we seem to be begging this question of, shall we keep a gross receipts surtax in place, or shall we look at something, or do you even want us to make the effort to look at an approach to it on some kind of a tax on the margins, which automatically would reflect the inflation and deflation in costs? And I guess to use Mary Ann's own vernacular from the other day, last time we broached this, you said, I don't want either because it's just being the choice between being boiled in oil or stoned. But the discussion here has evolved to you saying, presuming, begging the question, you do wish to be boiled in oil, we're only debating the temperature. But you know, do you want us to leave the stoning option on the table, or would you like us to pursue it?
I feel like I'm back boiled in oil and stoned again.
But it is a quite serious question. Yeah. I mean, do you want the stoning option?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, that's always a very difficult question to answer. But maybe I could just give you our perspective on it. What's on the table, we believe, is bizarre and creates a somewhat unworkable outcome for Alaska. A regressive tax regime at low prices, with a rampantly progressive regime bolted onto the top of it. I don't think it's what any of the economists or the design team or anybody ever intended for this tax structure to end up like. And I think it wouldn't serve the industry well, and it would certainly wouldn't serve the state of Alaska well in the long term. We have always said that progressivity is not appropriate for Alaska. But I would say that if you are determined that progressivity has a place in the final solution that this committee and the legislature finds, then we would certainly encourage you to look at very much more simple options, something that is based on margins rather than gross, something that is inflation-proof, and something that will work for the industry and for Alaska. and something most critical of all is balanced across prices. And certainly what's on the table in either the House or the Senate with respect is nowhere near the answer. But we do recognize and accept that there are different ways of skinning this cat. There are different ways of delivering a solution that will work. And if that's one that you want to consider and is part of the ultimate solution that you propose, there are very much better ways of doing it.
Thank you.
Yeah, to use your boiling in oil, you're really raising the temperature in that by not indexing your progressivity now. You actually, in a $30 real price scenario, trigger that at some point in time just by virtue of the 2.5% inflation. It just doesn't, I don't believe that was the intent. Possibly it was, but it certainly seems to be punishing those who are in a really a low price environment still.
You would have to ask the chair.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, ma'am.
In terms of being boiled in oil, you're going to affect your investment when you shave off the upside. There's no question about it. It's a question of, you know, what is the balance and what degree you want to negatively impact investment. So the way to minimize that impact would be to set the threshold to kick in at a high enough level that you're, you know, getting up to our P80, P90 range, so you're not really impacting our economics as much. And 50 is not, certainly not high enough. I mean, that's well within our normal range of economics. You'd have to be much higher than that.
So what I've heard then is I heard Mr. Walker express a preference, you know, using this illustration, a preference for stoning as an ultimate vehicle. And you're still back preferring to be boiled in oil.
But, at temperature.
But I think, I mean, I'm really hearing a difference of opinion between the two, two perspectives you bring to us working for different companies.
But, you know, the truth is we really, because we're so much against the windfall profits tax, we really haven't thought through if you had to do it, which would be the best way to do it. Really, we need to give that some more thought because we really are very much against the principle of it.
And if I might just follow on, I'd like to hear Mr. Dickinson's comments on this subject, because I know he and I have spoken offline, and I've heard from him a strong preference for the receipt surtax approach, and I'd just like to have his answer on the record. And
Representative Walker, through the chair, and again, what I want to tie that in with the other comments I made, which I believe in a conversation, which I said, you know, to answer the questions here, the flatter the better. The further to the right it starts, the better. And I don't believe we actually did talk about inflation. And my point would be, if you are truly going to the extraordinary situation, a dramatic price run-up, a supply dislocation, a price in the $102 to $100 range, at that point, cost consideration, those kinds of things become less relevant. And the old Hollywood phrase, you don't get a piece of the gross, not a piece of the net, applies. So, I think, you know, what our conversation was, you reported correctly. I just think it's important to put it in the full context. I think if you look at the governor's proposal, there was nothing in there, and to the degree that something comes in, we believe the one that has the least impact on investment is important, and therefore it needs to be off in that range where I think some of the considerations we've been talking about aren't as relevant.
Representative Harper. And maybe for Mr. Dickinson, finishing the thought here, really, if we do, we make the policy call that we want progressivity in this. We do want to keep the progressivity, and if we make the policy call, we want to keep the progressivity on a gross receipt surcharge. Wouldn't that really be better structured as a component of the state income tax rather than as a component of the production tax?
Representative Hawker, through the chair, I haven't thought through that. It seems to me that we already have a defined point, gross value point of production, in the production tax, and that seems to be, if you're going to a gross receipts, to be a place to hit it. I, quite frankly, haven't thought through. I mean, it seems to me in income tax, we generally don't distinguish upstream tax from cross, so I may be three steps behind you where that would come out.
Let me catch you up three steps. I'm thinking in terms of the argument for simplicity, that instead of, you know, we work this whole PPT thing out at a flat rate, which suddenly makes it much easier to deal with. easier, not simple, but easier to deal with. And it'd be awfully easy to write some kind of a gross receipts provision that was a surtax on the state corporate income tax. You know, you take a look at your gross revenues, you say what you sell, a very simple calculation, and tack it onto your corporate income tax.
Well, through the chair, I think that may be. You have already put in other provisions such as the private royalties, which also use the standard of the gross value point of production. So that's why I was focusing on that. But perhaps we can talk about that. We can answer that further.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the indulgence.
Okay. Barry, did you have a comment?
On the mechanism. I mean, I think the mechanism that I laid out, which would allow for costs to increase, allow for the threshold to move this cost increase. And I think that I don't have to go out and implement that. I've worked with the Department of Revenue on a number of occasions and I understand the process that they have to go through in these things. But it seemed to me that struck the right kind of balance of making sure that you're not having that margin shrink as costs go up.
Through the chair, I'd probably consider it's clear by now that that our view of the primary effect of this the tax rise is to do with lowering investment. But on this point of structure, if I could make a comment about the prospective system that I think everybody agrees is regressive to reasonable prices on the low side and progressive to reasonable prices on the high side. That, in my experience, is pretty well unique. And I can't say that there's nowhere else in the petroleum-producing world that has a system that would give that kind of effect. But it certainly doesn't exist in any of the other developed world mature areas. The level of complexity and the combination of regressiveness on the downside and progressiveness on the upside. Mm-hmm. And I can't believe that any economist would advocate that structure as a support for decision making. I think the consequences of the structure are actually very hard to anticipate, whereas the consequences of the overall rising tax rate are fairly obvious. The consequences of the fine points of structure, and a structure which is as complex as the one you will have in Alaska with five separate levels of taxes, each with a separate calculation, a separate taxable base, and a separate set of rules, some of which interlink with each other, it's very, very hard to anticipate what the consequences of that will be, except for the fact that the consequences are to add to the uncertainty that surrounds investment decision making.
Barry?
I know one of the goals, in what was done was to move the system into a more progressive structure generally. The old structure is regressive, period. I mean, it's just, and I think folks looked at that and said, that's not a good thing. Let's see if we can't put a system in place that is progressive, or at the very least moves us towards progressivity. And if you look at the base PPT, it does that. It moves you. It doesn't get you to progressivity overall. It has. I mean, it's certainly the as we showed yesterday, the effective tax rate moves up as prices move up. But as far as thinking about government take and progressivity there, the base PPT does not do that. But it gets you closer. So relative to the old system, it is. I think people viewed it as a benefit and a move in the right way. And then I know just in talking with folks who have put additional progressive piece on, the notion behind that was, well, let's correct if we can for this, the fact that we don't get quite there with just the base PPT, see if we can't get that more corrected relative to the old system. So,
Representative Kelly.
I guess getting very hit part of it, but the regressive part, the locked in 1/8
is pretty much there to stay. We can change that later if the pipeline's down to 290 and you guys might run her another 5 years if we dipped into the royalty and captured a little more on at the very tail end. But if that royalty isn't going to change on this pass. So we're stuck with that regressivity. It's there and it isn't going to go anywhere. But so then we're talking about the elements of the of any progressive thing. And at one point in time, I think if the public were watching, they might have been a little confused by the agreement when we were talking about three elements that I see very separately, and I know you do as well, but looking in from the outside, the whole idea of when it kicks in, 50, 40, 70, or whatever, is what we hear you say is we want that if we're stuck with progressivity to be outside of a reasonable P lower, P upper range. And so whether the 50 or, you know, your oil folks are going to say it ought to be 60, 70, 80 or high as they can get it naturally before that kicks in, and that the regular tax, 2020, 2025, whatever it is, will operate in the normal range. And then the next thing, of course, is the inflation. And I don't think there's a soul arguing about that. That's got to be fixed. Otherwise, we're into progressivity at if we started at 50, 40, 30, whatever. That doesn't make any sense. And then the other thing is the cap, because if we don't, we just take that rate and run it out at infinity, we have all the bucks out of the profit, minus some little small N out there. So those are three very, very separate elements, even though they touch down on the table in relation to one another. And I just think that's important to understand. And then the boiling and oil versus stoned was Representative Hawker. And I thought that was a great debate because I heard in the end that although the other day it sounded like most folks were going for the net, as Representative Hawker's talking about, and keeping it simple, to Angus's point, Barry makes an excellent point about being a little bit worried about the Hollywood example of you went off the net or the gross. So whereas I had kind of moved over toward the net idea if we were going to progressivity, I got to rethink that. It's the other thing, just as we think about this, I still got to say it every time we get to talking too much about this being totally a tax. If you ignore all of the names of what we call this, it's still some way to figure out what our bucket of oil, yard of concrete, million board feet of timber, the thing we own that you want to take over to your statement that's called cost of goods sold. And I just don't want to get drug into thinking this is all about tax and that it doesn't have some intrinsic bucket of oil over here that has a value out there in the play. So I think fairly pricing that, if we make a mistake on the high side, is just like me inaccurately pricing a sale of timber to the warehouser or anything like that, concrete going into a major project. So I just think I always get nervous when we start thinking about this totally as tax. It's just a bunch of squirrely ways to get to a number that intrinsic value is for that bucket of oil. And you can call it tax, you can call it royalty, you can call it income tax, you can call it property tax, whatever it is, it'll only stand so much of that. It's called the price of that going into your equation. But if we'd have frozen that in the 1950, we'd sure be sunk now. And so I really worry about a long-term freezing of that. But I also think that it's helpful to hear the debate back and forth on the 2520, which is operating always for you in the operating range versus the progressivity, which if we said it kicks in at $300 a barrel, argument's over. Nope, none of you have a problem with that, especially if we inflate it. So if we somewhere at a point in time you would fall out of love with that as it creeps down toward 50 or 40, I understand. Anyway, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions?
I didn't know.
Through the chair, I think first of all, I'll just make a comment. We absolutely have to convince you that if you went down this route, that we convince you that net is the right answer because gross, we believe, will just create an unworkable solution. The second thing I just wanted to say, and I think you were referring to the share between the industry and the state. And I just wanted to be really clear about what moved from the existing status quo to the 2020 proposal does to the share. By our calculations, under the status quo, the state receives 32%, and I'm talking about $60 a barrel here. The federal government receives 25%, and the industry receives something over 43%. Now, that's just the nature of the regressive regime that has served Alaska well. Under the PPT 2020, the state share moves from 32 to 40%. Significant increase, 32 to 40%. The federal government share goes from 25 to 22%. So I hope they're not watching. And the industry share goes from 43% to 38%. So just repeat, the state share would be 40%, the federal government 22%, and the industry 38%. So moving to the 2020 has substantially shifted the share. And I just think that's very important to realize when people start talking about bolting on, you know, further take on top of that. Thank you.
Any other comments? Richard.
Yeah,
I'm still a little, not so much confused, but earlier when we first started this morning, you stated that the companies had kind of come to an agreement on these numbers so that it would eventually link up with some type of a gas line thing. Now, what happens at the end of the session when we pass this, but we don't do anything about the gas line? What are your ideas on that? If there is no link.
Through the chair, I think the obvious consequence of agreeing to the 2020 and then having no gas line means that we have a substantial increase in tax, and therefore our business is less attractive, and the industry over time will invest less. That's just the law of economics. But we remain very hopeful that we can A, come to a sensible agreement on oil taxes, and secondly, that we can progress with the gas pipeline, because that's what we all want to do.
Well, next question. What issues are different when considering a progressivity surcharge on gas? Nobody wants to answer that one yet.
I think it's the same issue as with oil. We don't like progressivity above and beyond what the 2020 does on anything, but I think it's even worse on gas because we're talking about a $20 billion pipeline investment. We need to do additional exploration to fill that pipeline. And so because of the high cost of the investment and the long lead time, it just makes the economics that much more difficult. So I think it's every objection we have to the oil plus.
If I could just make one clarification, and I'm sure this is clear to people, gas economics are different, traditionally more expensive to get to market, which is obvious because of the $25 billion pipeline. But in any event, the gas fiscal contract will govern the fiscal terms for the gas on the North Slope, and not the terms that are here in the PPT. So therefore, I believe, certainly from our perspective, it's an issue for the Cook Inlet and maybe some other producers.
Mr. Chairman, I tend to agree with what Mr. Walker just said. I think the focus, and another focus, again, to agree with what Marianne said, one of the questions on oil and progressivity is, are folks getting that price? In other words, you have a price out there, and I think generally when oil is being delivered to the West Coast and you use a West Coast price or WTI, you're fairly accurately tracking what's going on. In the Cook Inlet, in the bill that CS in front of you, Henry Hub price is used to index the gas. And I think you can look at Gilliland and you can ask yourselves how many people are in fact getting a realization of Henry Hub for their sales. And the answer is not many. It may be increasing over time. Gilliland's in flux, the markets there are changing, but right now you really only have one major contract tied to Henry Hub, and you have other contracts that are sometimes literally an order of magnitude lower price than that. So I think that's another question you need to ask about using the indexes in the CS reporting.
Okay, we'll try one, Representative Kelly.
Just if you take out the Cook Inlet problem and say that, you know, that their price may be $4 and Henry Hub $6 or something, and all over the place because they're in a somewhat stranded situation. If you take that out of the equation, just talking about the slope to Chicago for a moment, with all respect for the all Alaska route folks, you are more nearly talking about a WTI ANS type comparison on the west, at the west. And all of the industry's concern about progressivity respected. We're still talking about pretty much an apple and an apple, not on how you dial in the numbers, because gas is a different deal, but the concept is still there. If we, in fact, were attempting to achieve progressivity, we would still be dealing with Henry Hub on the Chicago type delivery as a reasonable surrogate for trying to figure out somewhere to kick in the 50 or 60 that would apply to oil. Something on the order of, you know, $8 or some number on Henry Hub. Is that, am I off? I see some nodding yes, so I guess I'll say that maybe I'm not missing something if you take Cook Inlet out.
If I may, I think it's always important to try to go back to a wellhead value. In the case of WTI or ANS, there's a huge changes in the differential between the two. With that, going forward in time, the world's crude supply is getting more sour, and there's more stringent sulfur specs everywhere in the world. So I would expect the differential between light sweet crudes and sour crudes to widen over time. So I think over time, WTI is becoming an increasingly poor indicator for all of the world's crudes, not just Alaskan crude. So I think it's important to go back to the wellhead. Similar issues for natural gas. You don't have the quality issues, but depending on how much surplus pipeline capacity there is available to bring gas into the United States, you could have very wide-ranging differentials from Henry Hub. So I think it's important to go back to a wellhead, try to go back to a wellhead value and not tie it to things in the market where there's huge basis risk.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Well, they're playing our song. Unfortunately, I wish that we could have had the afternoon to spend 3 or 4 hours instead of just the hour and a half that we spent. I think that I'll talk to committee members and maybe we'd like to set up another one or two of these and maybe get to some different questions. If you have any written comments for the questions that were given you, we'd like to get a copy of that so we can get it to all the members. And maybe that'll help in further decisions on where we end up going ultimately with this thing, Representative Kelly.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to compliment you on the idea of setting up the debate with everybody here. Yeah. It was a little risky, and yet nobody shouted at one another. And so I think that's good. And I'd like to see two or three more of these.
Yeah, yeah.
And if we could throw on a question, mm-hmm. I just have one. In any gas contract, and this is probably for downstream, but any gas contract shouldn't it have a must-start-by date, just something to throw in the mix. For, it may not be talking about it for a month or two, but sometimes these wheels turn slowly.
And, so we'll be in contact with you. I know that you guys are leaving today. I know, Dan, you're around. Marianne and Angus, we can probably get a hold of you or get a counterpart of your corporation. I know that a couple have been left out, and it's more to do with the size of the room and the size of the table. So, and I'd like to get one going with Independence and talk to them about their specific issues and see if there's ways that we can address those without affecting other issues. So with that, I'll bring the meeting to a close this afternoon. At 1:30, we have legislation, House Bill 307, House Bill 493, and House Bill 105, and H.C.R. 330. So with that, I'll bring the meeting to a close once again. Thank you guys for being here, and we appreciate it.
I think that was a... What? Yeah.